Alles klar. Okay. Hello everybody, welcome to the lecture Architectures of Supercomputers. I am very excited for two reasons. First of all, this is the lecture with the most students I had so far. It's been increasing over the last years gradually. I think the first lecture was with just about 5 or 6 students. So I'm happy about that. And it's also the first time that the lecture actually gets recorded. I'm not sure if that's good because now I have to pay much more attention about what I'm saying. But yeah, as I said, I think it's a good thing and I'm excited about that. I'm very sorry that the beginning was a bit confusing because of the construction works in the Informatik Hochhaus. I hope that everything will be back to normal in about 2 weeks. Anyhow, in this lecture, I would like to give you an overview what to expect in the rest of the term, and I would like to try to equalize everybody's knowledge so we can start off with the same foundation. So may I ask you guys, who of you has heard in computer architecture lecture? Okay, I'm happy that not everyone is showing his hand because the first part of the lecture actually is a bit of computer architecture. So as I said, I would like to give everyone the same foundation. Let's start right off. Before we start with the actual content, I would like to clarify some organizational matters. As you know, the lecture is on Tuesday. Currently, it's scheduled for 12:15. It would be good for me if we could shift this to 12 o'clock, but it's not mandatory for me. Does anyone have a problem with starting at 12 o'clock? So it's good by everyone? Okay, so, yeah, please. Okay. Okay. So then I'll start at 12:05. Yeah. I'm always a bit worried because sometimes the lecture takes longer than expected, and I need to catch my bus afterwards to get home in time. Okay. So most of you may know that this is the link. I hope in the new room we'll have a better beamer. I'm sorry that the contrast is not that good. Okay, this is the full link. It's probably a bit too much to write down. So if you go to tinyurl.com/arcsub14, that should take you to our homepage. Okay, this is the link to our lectures. If you try Google, it should work out as well. As you know, we'll have an exercises group. In the exercises, we will do some programming exercises mostly to try to see the same effects I've tried to present in the lecture in actual code. My problem is that the exercise group is, I think, scheduled for Wednesday from 12 to 2 o'clock. And I have another exercises group at the same time. I'm not sure which optimization algorithm in the planning of our lectures decided it was good to expect from me to teach two exercises simultaneously. But as I said, I don't think it will work out. So I would like to try to find a new date, a new time, for the exercises to allow most of you to come. Okay, let me see. This won't work because this is when we have the exercises. This is where I have another exercise. And I think our original exercise was scheduled for this.
Oh.
12 to 2, okay. So this is also where the other exercise is for computational engineering one. So some of you have already heard that lecture. May I ask you guys for a show of hands, who could make it on Monday from 10 to 12? Not too many. 4, 5. Okay, 12 to 2. Acht. Okay, better. 2 to 4. And 4 to 6. 1, 2. Okay. Tuesday, 10 to 12. Tuesday, 4 to 6. Wednesday, 10 to 12. Sorry. That's good. Actually, that's the same time when our department has its internal meeting. That's a good excuse to not be there. 2 to 4 on Wednesday. 4 to 6 on Wednesday. 4 to 6 Okay, we are almost done. Thursday, 10 to 12. Twelve to two. Thursday, 2 to 4. Thursday, 4 to 6. Okay. At this point, I would like to take the liberty of canceling Friday, because that's my home office day. As some of you know, I've got a family, and that's usually the day when I bring my daughter to kindergarten, and she's always looking forward to that. And I'm actually very surprised to have this as the new date for our exercises. I will follow up with the room. I hope we can take the same room as we had originally planned, but I have to reserve it in our Univis. So, resolution Wednesday, 10 to 12. 10 to 12 on Wednesday. If you can't make it on Wednesday, that's okay. We can discuss the exercises also after the lecture or before that. The exercises are not mandatory, but my recommendation is to do them anyway, because there is a strong correlation between those students who have done all the exercises and those students who score good in the exam. I have had students who were good in the exam who didn't do the exercises, but that's very rare. So it's usually easier if you do the exercises. Okay. Speaking of which, the exam will be an oral exam, about 30 minutes, where we sit down, Professor Fei and me, with you, and I will ask you some questions on the exercises. The door is locked, I don't have a key. Hello? You need to take the other door. Okay. Sorry. Okay, so I don't know when we will have the exams, but we will agree upon a date, please.
When does the exercise actually start?
Oh, that's a good question.
If it's possible to start at 10:30, do you think that's not 10?
10:30? Okay, so. That's fine by me. Is it all right for the others? Sounds good. Yeah. Okay, good. Any questions regarding dates and? Okay. You didn't miss anything yet. I just said that exercises will be on Wednesday from 10:30 to 12 o'clock. Regarding the exercises, I will be on a business trip next week. So no exercises next week, no lecture next week. But back to normal the week after. Okay, so to start with the actual lecture, I would like to give you an overview of which chapters we will see in the following term and what we will talk about. As I said before, the beginning is really computer architecture. I'm trying to trim this computer architecture part to make it smaller, to take up less time, because as I said, it's really just an introduction, but still we'll need to cover some basic technologies, and this is why it still takes up probably a couple of weeks. We'll talk about first about principles of computer and processor architectures. Primarily, we'll talk about what computer architecture actually means, because this term is not strictly defined. So different authors have very different ideas about what computer architecture actually means. We'll see what that means and what people think about those. In the next part, we'll take a look at modern processor architectures. So we'll take a look at current Intel chips, but also on other designs like this is probably more of an historical interest. When I started the lecture, the power processor, a power cell or a cell processor was still state of the art. But today it's out of production and there isn't even a successor. So this is probably more out of historical interest. But we'll also take a look at GPUs and Intel's Xeon Phi, which has been marketed as the many integrated cores chip. There's a successor. I don't know when it's going to be released, but it's probably still a year out, which is called Knight's Landing, I think, a successor to the current Xeon Phi. A colleague of mine got some information on that, but I'm not sure if it's confidential or if I can disclose it, but we'll see. Anyway, what I'm trying to say, after we've learned principles of computer architecture, we'll take a look at the actual current processes. Then we'll move on to parallel computer architectures. So if we now know how one CPU works, how can we build systems with many CPUs? And then we'll take a look at networks, because all current supercomputers use networks. There's no monolithic supercomputer out there any longer. All current supercomputers consist of multiple computers which are networked. Actually, the networks we are using here for supercomputers are different from networks we use for PCs. So usually you would use Ethernet for a PC because that's what every machine has. It's cheap, it's reliable, it's compatible. Supercomputers usually have very different networks. It's interesting that InfiniBand is around there because it's also fast. It's relatively cheap, so one InfiniBand network card for your computer costs about 300 to 400 euros. That's affordable in terms of supercomputers. And you can even mix vendors. On the other hand, many other supercomputers have custom interconnects. So for instance, the Tofu interconnect has just been built for Fujitsu's K computer. And it's used just in maybe half a dozen machines worldwide. And they still design a custom interconnect for that. So, chapter 4, networks. And chapter 5, examples of supercomputers. In this chapter, which doesn't appear in this list to be that long because it's just one chapter, but actually this is the major part of the lecture. This is easily half of the term which will be taken up by this chapter. We'll take a look at the number one machines from the top 500 across, I think, the last 15 years. And we'll see how these machines have changed. We'll start with the Earth simulator and then move through other important designs, for instance, Roadrunner. Does anyone know what makes Roadrunner special? It's the first supercomputer whose performance exceeded one petaflop. So that was important in terms of, important symbolic feature. Its drawback was Roadrunner was very difficult to program for, so very few scientific applications actually were able to leverage the hardware. It was mostly used for nuclear weapons stewardship. Does anyone know what that means? So most of these machines we'll see are located in the US, and the US have a huge arsenal of nuclear weapons. And if you build a nuclear weapon and you put it in a shelf, you would like to know if you were going to use it tomorrow, which you of course aren't, but you would like to know if I were to use it, would it work? And nuclear weapons are a bit different from traditional weapons because of the decay. So the material is actually changing. And nuclear weapons stewardship refers to the task of simulating how these weapons change to figure out what adaptations are necessary or what effects might be caused by the decay. So, and because doing this by experiments is something we would rather not do, because you cannot do just for your testing, you cannot sacrifice one Southern Sea island at a time. It tends to be difficult to explain that to the press today. People prefer to buy huge computers to do these simulations in a computer, in a non-destructive way. So Roadrunner was used for Roadrunner was used for military purposes. That's also it was recently decommissioned, and most parts of it were shredded because they were afraid of leaking classified information. Titan is interesting in its own light because it's an open system, so you can apply for an account there. Actually, I had an account there, but it expired some months ago. It used to be the fastest machine until the Chinese brought online the Tianhe 2. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but actually this is sort of a running joke in the lecture, because every year I try to pronounce it correctly, and we often have, excuse me, are you from China? Okay, that's good, because then you can later on educate me on how this is properly pronounced. Okay. These will be the major machines we'll take a look at, but we'll also take a look at systems at the RRZE, our local compute center, and probably also on other systems from Germany or at least from Bavaria. Now, this has been the overview. Next part will be what is computer architecture? As I said before, this is not an easy question because it's not thoroughly defined. Different authors have different ideas what computer architecture is. So what I would say is computer architecture relates to computer science as biology relates to natural sciences. That's my idea. It's probably stupid, but there are some things both have in common. We have a family of architectures, and in biology, also part of biology deal with classifying and categorizing organisms. And that's a bit like computer architecture, where we try to see common traits of computers. And as I said, supercomputers are one family in the fauna of computers. A different family would be notebooks or today smartphones, right? What we also can see is that computer architecture changes in an evolutionary way, mostly. There are very little or very few moments when everything changes. We will also see some parts which have remained constant over the last 70 years. We even have co-evolution, so some changes, for instance, in a different family, like PCs, trickle or move to supercomputers. And we also see a varying variety. What that means is, after some time, the common or the usual design of a computer tends to be maxed out, and people cannot push it further to higher levels of performance. But of course, we want our computers to be faster and faster. And especially in terms of supercomputers, there's a lot of pressure behind that, because people need to further their science, people need faster machines, larger machines, and or more efficient machines. And whenever a new technology arrives, there tends to be an event of mass extinction. I've chosen that term because of biology. But actually, when you look at computers, you have very similar events. So for instance, the advent of CMOS caused huge parts of computer architectures to simply die and being stopped in production. So for instance, does anyone of you know Cray? Okay, so Cray is a major manufacturer of supercomputers, and they used to make their own computer designs completely from scratch. They were using for a long time bipolar transistors. Those were known to be very fast, so they were able to clock their CPUs very high. But they also had the problem of requiring a lot of power. So Cray was also one of the first companies to introduce liquid cooling, and they even had submersive cooling, so where they would place their CPUs beneath or inside a bath of cooling fluid, which would just boil off from the CPU, which looked very cool because it looked like an aquarium where they didn't have water but cooling fluid, and it boiled off and was cooled back on the top of the rack. The problem was, when CMOS arrived, the technology was so much colder because it didn't leak so much power, that development of CMOS went so fast that it exceeded what one Cray company could do. So they were outpaced, and ultimately they also embraced CMOS. So what I'm trying to say is, when CMOS came around, all computer architectures changed, because pretty much everyone embraced CMOS. Even my watch is based on CMOS technology. 10 years later, the PC arrived. The PC did not have an easy start, mainly because it was invented by IBM, and IBM did not want to enter the mass market. They wanted it to be a business machine. As you know, IBM stands for International Business Machines, I think. So the PC was initially decried for being too expensive and not being able to do a lot. Even if you took a look at games on the PC did initially have an inferior appearance compared to much cheaper computers like the Commodore C65. And only after time, the PC gained traction. But when it got traction, it led to very cheap designs being available, very cheap and very powerful designs being available. And what people did was, they replaced their very expensive supercomputers by a bunch of PCs, which they connected via a network. And suddenly, at least all supercomputer designs changed, because they all adopted PC hardware. And today, when we look at the top 500, I think over 80% of the supercomputers in the top 500 list are based on PC technology. 10 years later, PC was still going strong, but the problem was they were not able to raise the clock speeds any further. When I was studying, I was used to PC clock speeds getting higher and higher. But the problem was, the higher the clock speeds got, the more power the CPUs lost. And at a certain point, it simply didn't make sense to raise those clock speeds because the power losses got prohibitive. So what we can see today is that clock speeds are somewhere between 2 and 4 gigahertz, not much higher. Actually, I think this notebook has 2 gigahertz, and the notebook I had 5 years ago also had 2 gigahertz. But the difference is this has 4 cores, and the one 5 years ago had just 1 core. So what we can see is each new generation of CPUs has more cores, not more hertz. And it's difficult to say what's happening right now, but I would say the most influential change in supercomputers is accelerators. Does anyone of you know what an accelerator is? Please. Right, exactly. So an accelerator is some kind of additional hardware inside the supercomputer, which mostly does vector-like processing. The idea is it's often harder to program, but it's simultaneously more efficient. Most accelerators we've seen so far are GPUs made from NVIDIA, but also Intel has published its own accelerator, the Xeon Phi. It's currently not really clear who will succeed. Most people agree that there's probably just a market for one accelerator. And the problem of Intel is they are marketing their accelerator just for supercomputers. So, and supercomputers is not a mass market. Supercomputers is a niche market, very small. Each machine is very expensive. I think the cheapest machine in the top 10 currently cost $200 million. It sounds like a lot of money, but if you compare this with the size of the market for GPUs, which is mainly fueled by gamers, that's billions, not millions. Right? Okay, so I guess we'll have to see what happens. If you look at the current top 10 systems, we can say 4 are using accelerators, 4 are BlueJinQ, that's an IBM design, but IBM already said that they won't build a successor to BlueJinQ. So once these machines are phased out, we'll have to see what other design comes up, or if the successing machines will also use accelerators. And actually, only one machine is using a traditional Intel CPU solely. So I think it's a Cray XC30 machine in the US, and it doesn't have accelerators, just Xeon processors, Intel Xeon processors. No GPU, no Xeon Phi, no additional vector CPU. It's very expensive to build such systems with a high performance because you need a lot of nodes. I would say the performance density is low on these machines, so you have to take additional care for building a huge machine. It requires longer networking cables. It's simply more complicated to build such a machine. Animations, I'm sorry. Actually, the reason why the slides are built with PowerPoint is that I initially took Dietmar's computer architecture slides, and I was too lazy to transform them to LaTeX. And now I'm paying the price because there are quite a lot of surprises. We'll see some surprises later on, I'm afraid. I took a look at the slides before the lecture, and I tried to correct some of those, but I didn't see that animations were in there. Okay, so what does a computer actually do? How does it work? It operates on data. It processes data, it stores data, it transports data. If I look at my mobile phone, it transports data. Hello? Computer architecture? Supercomputer? Die ist, das ist eine Vorlesung? Bis 13.45 Uhr. Okay, so what does a computer do? It works on data, as I said before. If I look at my mobile phone, it's primarily used for transporting data from the internet to the internet. Sometimes I also use it for actually talking to people, but mostly for accessing the internet. It transports it from the network to my vision, to the display. So what does computer architecture do? It focuses on function, setup, and organization of components which process, store, and transport data. So in other words, it focuses on what a computer does. This is, of course, very, very unspecific. It doesn't really tell us much about what computer architecture really refers to. So we will take a look at what different authors have to say about this. The problem, as I said before, is there is no unique definition in literature, but rather every author has his own idea. The good thing is the different authors came all to the same conclusion, but they just assigned different labels to their conclusion. Okay, so what do I mean by this? The first definition is by Ungerer from the University of Augsburg, not very far from here. And he said, computer architecture consists of two parts, instruction architecture and endo architecture. Does anyone know what endo architecture means? That's good, because I also always forget. And luckily, we can read what it means. Okay, so the instruction architecture is a behavioral description of what a computer does on an abstract level. So it consists of machine data types, machine operations, instruction sets, interrupt systems, and the decomposition of data in memory. Usually, we don't really have a decomposition because most machines have a byte addressable memory. But then again, byte addressable memory is also already a decomposition, namely into bytes. So that's the instruction architecture. One could say this is all the software sees, right? The software sees which instructions are available. It sees where it can move which data. It sees which interrupts get called. It doesn't see much else. And the endo architecture refers to what's happening inside the computer. So the inherent structure and how the computer works inside. This endo architecture consists of three parts. The computer structure. Computer structure is actually a good word, because we'll see in the following definitions that some people assign a different meaning to computer structure. So this is mainly the static topology of which components I have and how they are connected. We have the information structure, which refers to how data is stored in main memory. And we have the operation principle, namely how the components and the data interact, how data flows, how control is transferred, this sort of thing. Now, the next definition is by Brück from the University of Siegen. I think Dietmar did his PhD at his chair, but I'm not 100% sure. Anyway, so he says, computer structure consists of computer architecture plus implementation. And we can already see that we know some of the words, but as I said before, they will have different meanings. So by computer architecture, Brück means that's the interface between the user and the computer. And by user, he means the software developer, the programmer, or in other terms, what the software sees. So machine organization, instruction set, that sort of stuff. And the implementation is how the hardware is set up, what functional units I have, how they are interconnected. And I think the similarity between Brück's definition and the definition of Ungerer should be apparent now. What the computer architecture is in Ungerer's terms is the computer structure in the terms of Brück. Anyhow. Both previous authors were Germans. Of course, they are also international authors. And if we look at the book of Stallings called Computer Organization and Architecture, we can see that computer organization consists of the operational units and interconnects, and computer architecture is the attributes of a system visible to the programmer. Now, this is, I think, what we've seen as the computer structure in Ungerer's definition. That's all very similar. So what I'm trying to say is, all authors agree that there's a separation between the interface visible to the software and the actual structure of the hardware. And this, they assign different labels to them, but all agree that this separation is existent. And actually, the good thing about the separation is that we can now identify families of architectures which share the same interface, but are or share similar internal structures, but are not too different from each other. Any questions on these architectures? You do not have to learn them out by heart. They are not part of the exam. I'm just trying to give everyone the opportunity to know what actually architecture means, because I cannot teach a course of supercomputer architecture without explaining what architecture means in this course. Although I have to say that architecture in the terms of building buildings has become an important subject for supercomputers, because many machines today are so large that they require their own building. And because they are so expensive, they are also sometimes used for representation. So some supercomputers are located in very fancy buildings. 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to visit the K computer in Japan, which was back then the fastest machine in the world. And they have built an earthquake-proof and flood-proof building just for the K computer. And inside, that's actually interesting, inside the building, the building obviously has multiple stories, and okay, so I'm simplifying the building. It's actually a bit nicer than what I'm drawing right now. As I said, it's earthquake-proof. So internally, in the basement, it's built on dampers, which allow the building to which allow the ground to move underneath the building without affecting the building. So it's located in Kobe, which is the south of Japan, and it's one of the areas where earthquakes can be very severe. Actually, it's built right on the coast, so I'm not sure if that's very clever. So if another tsunami strikes, I'm not sure. But they have their own cooling building right next to it. So in this building, they have cooling towers. And in the topmost floor, they have a huge room where the supercomputer is located. And in the floors beneath, they have cables and power supplies and all of this. Actually, there are also some offices in this building. But what I'm trying to say is the topmost floor, they also have a special room, which is just for viewing the supercomputer. So if you're visiting the RIKEN Compute Center or the RIKEN Research Facility, and you're lucky, then they will show you this room, and there you can view the supercomputer and take pictures. So when we were there, there was a conference, and everyone was invited to go there to see the marvelous supercomputer. So what I'm trying to say is, even for supercomputers, people tend to care about the architecture of the building where it's located. This building actually has its own subway station. Anyhow, let's move on to the von Neumann machine. Why is this important? I said before that some parts of our architectures haven't changed in the past about 70 years. And the von Neumann machine is part of this, or actually, this is what hasn't changed. This architecture was proposed by von Neumann and his co-authors Goldstein and Birx. And pretty much every design we see today still incorporates most of the von Neumann machine, which is interesting because architectures have changed so dramatically, but this is something they still have in common. The von Neumann machine is based on seven principles. the control unit, which interprets the instruction stream and generates control signals, the memory unit, which stores data and delivers data to the arithmetic logical unit. This is used for the actual computations. So all calculations are done in the ALU, and the memory unit moves data here and back. And we have an input-output unit, which is used for inputting data from a user or displaying data back. Interesting point is, in many modern computers, the I/O unit and the memory unit are fused, because to most current computers, when I'm doing I/O, it looks like I was just writing to a special memory address. It's not always the case, but for much of the I/O. But it's still, if you look at the hardware, you will still find a separate I/O unit. Okay, the second principle, the structure of the computer is independent of the computational tasks. It's controlled by the program. This may sound logical if you're used to looking at computers from a software developer's perspective, but it wasn't self-evident back then when the von Neumann machine was proposed. Because back then, many machines were built for special purposes. They were not able to execute different programs, but rather just one task. So if you go to the Informatik Hochhaus, I think on the second floor, there's a huge chunky machine standing around. And this was used by the military to compute the trajectories of of projectiles. So when ships got bigger and bigger, especially military ships, they realized that they could shoot their guns much further. But it was very difficult to actually hit a target, because computing where the projectile would land requires you not just to solve one simple equation, for instance, a cubic equation, but you actually have to account for wind drag, you have to account for the wind which is coming from the side, you have to account for the heat of the barrel. So these complications, these calculations tend to be very complicated, and they build a special computer just for calculating how to align the barrel to actually hit what they were trying to hit. And yeah, so what I'm trying to say, von Neumann said, well, we are building a generic computer which can calculate just about anything because it's controlled by a program. I said before that I'm a bit angry at myself because I'm using PowerPoint for these slides, because what happened was, when I was updating the slides, PowerPoint was complaining because I had some typos in there. What PowerPoint didn't understand was that it was thinking the slides were in German, but they were actually written in English. So you can tell PowerPoint, please don't check for German, but check for English spelling. So I marked all items on the slide, and then I said, okay, this is now English, which is okay. It worked out for the text fields, but suddenly these boxes were not resizable. They shrunk to their original size, and now I can't, if I quit the presentation mode, and when I try to resize this box, I can try it, but it doesn't actually do anything. Now you could imagine that I'm missing some secret switch which allows me to resize this, because maybe it's locked, right? But if I try to resize it in the horizontal way, So I can make the boxes wider or narrower, but I cannot change the height. If any one of you knows PowerPoint, please come to me after the lecture. I really don't know what to do. Anyhow, so. Okay, what I said before, we had hardware which was programmed in hardware, where you had to change the actual hardware to change what it was doing. And the von Neumann architecture is software programmed. So we have instructions which are being interpreted. we have data which is moved through the arithmetic logical unit and control signals from the instruction interpreter. This is actually the control unit, change how these, how this data gets modified. The third principle, programs and data are located in the same memory, and in theory, they can be modified by the computer. Does anyone know why this might be a bad idea? That's a good point. Yeah, right. So modern CPUs have different level one caches for instructions and for data. So if the program tries to modify its own instruction stream, the data might end up just in the data cache, but not in the instruction cache. So it might not work. There are workarounds for this, but actually some software, some malicious software, tries to exploit this behavior to fool security scanners. Okay, another reason why this might be a bad idea, besides that it might not work. Actually, I think I already gave a hint. It's for security reasons. You may know from the news buffer overflow attacks. Okay, buffer overflow attacks mainly refer to that some user input is sent, for instance, to a server, but instead of adhering to the rules set by the server, for instance, the server might say, okay, please reply to me with a string of at most 1,024 bytes. And some attackers would exploit this and send more bytes. And if the server is not programmed in a secure way, it might accept the extraneous data and overwrite some of its internal data, because some this buffer, which it's using internally, is just 1,024 bytes large. And if it's receiving 2K, 4K, or even 1 megabyte, it might overwrite some of the internal data. And depending on how the program is written, this new data may be a new program. And by sending malicious data to a web server, I might be able to make this web server run my own code, which is perhaps not what the inventors had in mind. Right? So in the extreme case, I might be able to modify what a server in my own bank is doing. Might be good, might be bad. Okay, so but in principle, both are located in the same memory, and this is also often a good idea because this allows me to write new programs on the same machine where I'm testing those, because essentially I'm creating new programs by the use of programs. The fourth principle is main memory is divided in cells of the same size, which are addressed by a consecutive number. Most modern machines use byte addressable memory. There are some exceptions. So for instance, I think on ARM processors, you may only address your memory in terms of words, depending on which processor you have. A word is 32 or 64 bits long, sorry. So if your memory access is not aligned within these boundaries, you will get a, depending on your architecture, a segmentation fault. Fifth principle, programs consist of a sequence of instructions which are executed mostly in sequence, otherwise it wouldn't be a sequence, right? So this means I have a list of instructions and the CPU looks at one after another. I may have jumps in those. So for instance, I can create loops, I can call functions. This may sound simple, but some of the original computer programming languages did assume that there were really just a sequence of instructions. We will see some very simple architectures later on in the course which did not allow jumps. So for instance, the first GPUs, which were programmable, could not execute jumps, which changed the way how programmers had to work with them. Because sometimes if you're not able to execute a branch, you have to be very careful about the program to still work in every condition. The sixth principle, as I said before, we can have jumps, conditional jumps, depend on some flags. So for instance, I can do some computation before, and this computation might set some flags in my CPU, and depending on these flags, I might jump or not jump. And the final principle, the von Neumann architecture uses a binary coding scheme, which is, I think, a bit surprising because it was mainly a theoretical principle when the paper was published. And today it's easy to think about computer architecture of a result of the available hardware. So theoretically, we would be able to create hardware which does not use a binary coding scheme, but for instance, a coding scheme based on three states or four states. So if you look closely at flash hardware, so when you're buying a new memory card or a new SSD for your computer, the flash might actually be able to use multiple states per cell, not just two states. But still, the encoding we use in the computer is binary, which has a couple of advantages. Mostly it's very reliable, and all of our tools rely on this. So it's also easy to debug. Now, let's take a look at the parts which we've listed before, the components of the von Neumann architecture. It consists of the memory unit, control unit, execution unit, and I/O unit. We've seen this before. And internally, perhaps most important is the control unit, because this is interpreting the instruction stream. What's important here is the program counter. This is the address in memory where I'm reading my instructions. The memory unit will use this address to fetch data from main memory, move the data to a special register which holds the data, and supplies it to the control unit so the control unit can interpret it and generate control signals for the execution unit. The execution unit will now compute, work on the data, compute it, and may read data from the memory unit or write data back. And the I/O unit is also controlled by the control unit and may display numbers to the user or read numbers from the user. Very high level overview. These are the basic principles. And as I said before, still most of these components show up if you look at an actual modern CPU design. Okay, now we know all the parts of the system. I would like to take a look at how it actually operates. And in the von Neumann architecture, the execution of a single instruction is split into multiple phases. First of all, the instruction is fetched from the memory unit. It is decoded. Then operands are fetched for the for the instruction. And when I know what I'm going to compute, and if I have all the data, I can actually execute. And finally, I'm writing back results, and I'm computing the next address. So the next address is the next address of the following instruction. Usually, it's just the next instruction in main memory, but it may be, because of a jump, a different address. And the next instruction again starts with an instruction fetch phase. This is not totally new. It was also preceded in other designs. So in Germany, we tend to be proud of Konrad Zuse, because he's also one of the early inventors of the computer. If I'm not mistaken, he was the first one to build a programmable electronic computer. It was using relays and not integrated circuits. But if you look closely, I would say that Charles Babbage was preceding him, because he also had a programmable computer, but it wasn't electronic. It was built on mechanical designs. So I'm not sure how well this worked, but I think others have tried to build machines from his designs, and I think they have worked. Okay, we can take a look at the instruction cycle as a state diagram. it looks more complicated than it actually is, because as you know, it's really just a sequence. But it looks more interesting if you display it in a zigzag pattern. So we first fetch the instruction, we decode it, we fetch the operands, sorry, we compute operand addresses, fetch the operands, execute the instruction, and write back results and compute the address of the next instruction. If we have multiple operands, we might need to repeat those phases. Oh, sorry, I was mistaken. Actual storing of results happens here. So I compute the address where I'm trying to store data, and then I'm storing those. And this might be done multiple times because I might have multiple results. Actually, most architectures I know today just store one result. Okay, so depending on if I'm working on vectors, I might have to repeat this cycle. Vector instructions operate, apply the same operation on different datas, different parts of the data. If I'm not doing vector processing, I might just end up here and fetch the next instruction. Okay, I'm rushing a bit through the first part of the lecture, because as I said, it's really just to give everyone the same background. If you have questions, please interrupt me. Next part, so we now know basic computer architecture. We know how Neumann defined his for Neumann machine. And so this gives us sort of a basic understanding of how a computer works. I would like to introduce some of the more recent features. And this is microprogramming. Why is microprogramming important? Or what is it actually? It's, first of all, it's not a new it's not a new idea. So Wilkes did mention it in the 1950s. So in terms of computer sciences, this is really not a new idea. One could describe microprogramming as a kind of inner von Neumann computer. I would say it's that's thinking of too much. But what's really is, if you look at a computer program, it's made up from assembly instructions, which are to be executed by the CPU. But sometimes these assembly instructions are actually too complicated for a CPU. So we might want to break these instructions down into micro instructions. And microprogramming refers to exactly this, that an assembly instruction is broken down by the CPU into smaller, simpler tasks. The first breakthrough was by IBM with the System 360, but it was not used for general purpose machines in the mass market for quite a while. So what do these microprograms provide us? First of all, compression. If my instructions are more expressive, more complex, which I can use as a software developer, because I know the machine will make up these complex instructions from simple instructions, I can write shorter programs. So when memory was very expensive, I was able to save memory and therefore save money. It's also more flexible, because even if the hardware is fixed, I can often change the microprograms afterwards. So I can change how instructions work, or I can even add new instructions to my existing machine. You see this third bullet point here, semantic gap. Does anyone know what that refers to? It's also a part of Dietmar's slides, and I tend to forget what it actually means. So
I think there's a problem between understanding assembler code and maybe higher languages like C.
Mm-hmm. Ah, okay. So yeah, that's a good point. So initially, people did not program CPUs with a high-level language like C or Java, but they used assembly. And as I said, assembly used to be very limited, and each instruction was not able to do a lot. But with microprogramming, people were suddenly able to use very powerful assembly instructions. So this would gap between a complex program, which was now able to use complex instructions, and the simple hardware. Thank you. Okay, so why did I put this image here? This is an image of a Xeon Phi coprocessor. This is currently the fastest vector or CPU which is Intel selling. It's also the only vector CPU, but yeah, as I said, it's the fastest. It's primarily meant as a competition for NVIDIA's GPUs, and it costs a couple thousand euros, so it's really not cheap. And when they had to rush the designs because NVIDIA was conquering the supercomputing market with their GPUs, with a Tesla line of GPUs, which also cost a couple thousand euros, which is a bit more expensive than gaming CPUs, GPUs, sorry. But they were well tested, they were working very well, and they were outpacing Intel's CPUs. So Intel had to do something. So they basically copied the design principle of a GPU. They built a PCI Express card, which you can plug into your standard CPU. They had a very powerful many-core CPU here, which was not very good at out-of-order execution. So that's actually what Intel CPUs is doing very well. So they use very simple cores, but many cores. This is also why the Xeon Phi was called MIC, or MIC, many integrated core. And they did add very fast DRAM with a bandwidth of more than 100 gigabytes per second. That's a lot. But it had one problem. It was not able to do divisions. And you, depending on how much math you had in your studies, you may remember that a division is a task you have to do in some programs, right? So that was kind of unfortunate. And because they had to rush out the hardware, they were not able to add a division unit or a divider to the hardware because it just had to be finished. So what they did was they added a microprogram for divisions. And this microprogram breaks down a division into multiple phases. Actually, I think it even contains a loop. And it computes a division from a series of additions, subtractions, multiplications. And it's really slow. So any code which is meant to run on the Xeon Phi, which is using divisions, will run horribly slow. But actually, GPUs are quite good at divisions. So initially, when the Xeon Phi was launched, people were disappointed and said, I paid a couple thousand euros for this single card. And some computers are built from thousands of these cards. And they were disappointed and said, well, this cannot be. Why is this so slow? And the reason is, yeah, they can do divisions, but only via a microprogram. So I said before that a microprogram is a series of micro instructions, and what the programmer writes is a series of macro instructions, which are then broken down into a series of micro instructions. Theoretically, both are very similar. So a microprogram, if I compare it to a computer program is basically what I use to program my computer. And a microprogram, so it consists of macro instructions and high-level instructions. For instance, if I'm using C or C++, they get converted to assembler instructions, which are still macro instructions. A microprogram is usually stored in a firmware. So if I boot up my computer, the BIOS will usually load the firmware to the CPU, which then redefines how instructions are executed. So sometimes if a flaw in a CPU is discovered, Intel will issue updates to the manufacturers of mainboards, and those will implement those updates in their own BIOS updates. And then the users can download the BIOS updates, and when they restart their computer, some flaw or some bug in the CPU might be fixed because of the new firmware. It's not very nice, so it's sort of, you would expect when I'm buying a CPU that it's working correctly, but most CPUs you buy have more than 50 bugs inside. But those are very rare, so they are usually not triggered. When Intel launched the first Pentium processor, there was a bug, a division bug, actually. So you see that Intel does not have a good track record with divisions. And this caused it to, under certain conditions, when certain flags were set, And when certain previous instructions were executed, it caused it to miscalculate the result of the division. And the result was that some codes did not crash, but instead they returned the wrong results, which is actually worse than crashing, because when a code crashes, you know that something went wrong. But if it's delivering just one result, which you can't check because you are using the code to compute this value, then this is really bad. And so what they did was they did recall all Pentium CPUs. All were sent back to Intel, and Intel distributed new CPUs with a fixed design. That was hugely expensive, and it was, more importantly, it was a huge blow to Intel's image, because they used to have this image of being very professional, and suddenly they appeared no more professional than their competition like AMD. So not all bugs today can be fixed via a new microprogram. Okay, so how does this work internally? Usually a macro instruction is sort of defines an initial address for the microprogram, and animations, hooray. And as I said before, the microprogram consists of multiple instructions which are then executed in sequence. And after the microprogram ends, the next macro instruction is being fetched from main memory. I think the original slides did mean us to take a detailed look at this. We will not. And instead, we'll take a look at another example. Okay, if you have seen any, pretty much any lecture from this chair, you should know this chart. Does anyone know it? Okay, that's very good. If you don't know it, that's okay. I'll explain it in detail. Okay, what this is meant is to be a very simple CPU. From a hardware designer's perspective, it's too simplistic, because you cannot do it that easily. But from a teaching perspective, it's perfect, because it's got all the problems you will typically see when designing a real CPU, but without the complexity which would make it too confusing. On the left, we have different control signals. When I'm setting those control signals to one, those functional units will be activated. So for instance, if I activate control signal 3, the adder will compute the results of the data it's receiving from A and B. If I activate control signal 7, this register, so these rectangles with rounded corners are registers, will save the input it is receiving from the adder. And these triangles are actually switches. If I activate those, they will let data pass. If I deactivate those, they will block data. This is important, for instance, if I'm trying to load a new value to D, I should enable just one of these three switches. Depending on which I'm enabling, I will load different data to D. So for instance, if I enable this switch, that would be control signal 8, and I activate control signal 11, then I would load the result from the adder unit to D. If I did enable, let's say, control signal 10 and 11, I would let data from main memory pass and let it be stored in D. As I said before, it's a bit confusing, but the principle is actually very simple. You just have to remember that this is working with a clock. So all registers will output the data they have stored only in the next clock cycle. And if I don't load new data, the output will remain constant. And using this, we can compute some, or we can try to come up with a microprogram for something interesting. Let's see. Okay, so we are trying to implement A minus B and store the result back in A. Sounds simple, but we'll see that it's still not self-explaining, at least if you take a look at this for the first time. I'm just writing this down because we have to skip back to the original design. Okay, so I want to compute A minus B and store it back into A. If I look here at the adder, I can see that A minus B is control signal 4. If I would activate control signal 4 now, just for one cycle, the result would be lost because I have to store it somewhere. And to store it somewhere, I have to store it, for instance, in C. There are different solutions to this task, so I could take any detour I like, but I'm trying to come up with the fastest solution. So for the first cycle, I will activate control signal 4 and 7. 4 will do the actual computation for me, A minus B, and 7 will cause the result to be stored in C. So I will now make a table, the clock, and the signals. And in the first cycle, as I said, I'm activating control signal 4 and 7. Are there questions? Please ask questions if you're not sure how this is working, because, as I said before, it's not complicated, but if you don't understand in the beginning, it can get confusing in the end. Okay, so I have computed A minus B, and it's now stored in C, but my task was to store it in A. So I have to figure out a way to move the data from here back up there. The problem is that these data paths are one-way streets only. I cannot move data back here through the adder. So I have to go down here and then traverse here up and store it there. So the next cycle would be, I would open this switch, that would be control signal 13, and then I would activate control signal 2 to load the result in A. So what did I just say? 13 and 2. And this is already it. So our microprogram is actually rather short. It's just two instructions and we're done. Right? That's good. In the exercises, I think we'll do something more complicated where we'll have to read from main memory and move data a bit further along the CPU. But that's basically it. Any questions? Okay. By the way, if you do the exercises and you, as I said, you'll probably be tasked to create another microprogram. Please don't do it in this way. But in a way, it's of course logical because it lists for each signal if it's 0 or 1, but it's very hard to read because there's just so much information. And the only meaningful information is which signals are high. You can simply imply that all other signals are low. So I like this way of displaying it better than this one, even though both are identical. Okay, I think I'll skip the part about jumps. Basically, the design we had here was not able to execute jumps because the next address would be always just plus 1. So there's no jump unit. We could extend the design, and I did leave in the slides simply because maybe someone's interested, but it's not really relevant to this lecture. So I can include conditional jumps by additional hardware, and this hardware is just there for computing the following address. And depending on the signal, I may not add just plus 1, but plus 2. The problem with this is it's only able to skip one instruction, so it's not able to execute arbitrary jumps. But that probably doesn't matter. Okay, so we've seen this table with all signals listed before. And I said it's sort of clunky, it's not really easy to understand. And actually it's also a problem for computer architecture, because if I store every bit And in modern CPU designs, I might have thousands of control signals, and I also might have thousands of microinstructions. This means that I have to store a lot of memory, right? And usually, this firmware is used to be small, and the memory which holds the microinstructions should be even smaller. So that's some part which is usually expensive on the CPU design because it has to be very fast. And one way to reduce the amount of memory is to use a decoder. And this decoder is meant to single out duplications in my data. So as I said before, in my even at this simple CPU, I'm not allowed to activate certain multiple control signals simultaneously. So for instance, I'm not allowed to require the adder to add and subtract simultaneously, because it can always do just one task. So it makes sense to say, I'm just using two control signals, and depending on which values they have, 00, 01, 10, and 11, only one of the control signals for the adder will be activated. Simultaneously, it makes sense to, when I'm looking at the data paths, to select just the adder, just input, just memory, or let me take a look. Or for another input, just select C or D, or just control the jump instruction. Oh, sorry, that's a different part. So what I'm trying to say here is, because I'm only allowed to activate certain signals simultaneously, I can remove the duplication by using decoders. And this allows me to store my microprograms more compact. Does anyone know how this is called? Which type of microprogramming this is? Sorry? Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I have to say that I always confuse those, and I always have to read this up before giving another lecture. Yeah, but it's vertical microprogramming. We will see what this means in detail in the following on the following signals, slides. Sorry. So, how does a microprogrammed control unit actually look like? As said before, that I have to store somewhere the micro instructions, and I walk through these micro instructions usually in sequence. So I have a sequencing logic, and I have a control address register, which is usually initialized from the macro instruction, and then later on maintained. And I have a control buffer register, which stores the actual control signals. And in horizontal microprogramming, which is not what we see on the last slides, but what we could see in the very wide table, which did list all control signals, I would have all internal CPU signals, uncoded, uncompressed. Also, signals for the system bus, and then jump conditions and the address of the next micro instruction. And these jump conditions is really just used for conditional jumps. The micro instruction address is important because sometimes I'm not using just the next micro instruction in sequence, but sometimes I have to jump in the micro program because, for instance, I need to load the next macro instruction. Okay, so in vertical microprogramming, I'm not listing all functional codes here. I'm not listing all control signals here, but rather function codes. And these function codes would be then forwarded to decoders. And this is also why this is called vertical microprogramming, because if I list all the decoders here, suddenly all my control signals are listed in a vertical manner. There's some way to remember what vertical and what horizontal microprogramming is, if you need to remember it. So, if I take a look at these schematics, the decoder would sit here. So I'm still reading the content of the control memory verbatim, but then here I'm decoding it and generating the corresponding signals. Does anyone know the disadvantage of this? I mean, it sounds good, right? I'm saving memory, and that should be good enough. Please.
It needs
Right.
Actually being executed.
So this additional logic adds delay to my control signals. And if I'm interested in clocking my CPU very high, I might not have this time to add an additional decoder. But that's the task of the hardware engineers. That's not mine, because I'm a software engineer. So I just assume that they will work their magic and the hardware will just work faster than previous hardware. OK, we still got some time. So how are interrupts handled? Does anyone know what an interrupt is? Please?
Interrupt is an exception coming from outside of the processor.
Yeah.
So like some input-output units are communicating with the processor, then they interrupt him at what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah,
that's a very good example for an interrupt. When the user types a key, strokes a key, then the computer should react to this. And usually when you think about how to design an I.O. unit, there are two ways of checking for I.O. One is to force the program to periodically look at the state of the hardware. And so for instance, every 10 microseconds, I could take a look at my keyboard hardware and see if the user has pressed some keys. That's usually very bad because users don't press keys any 10 microseconds. So I'm wasting a lot of time. And the other solution would be an interrupt, which is forced by the hardware to make the software do something. So in a PC, for instance, you have to register interrupt handlers for different interrupts. And these are usually parts of the operating system. And these take care of addressing the needs of the hardware. Another example would be the output to the sound card. Back then, when we had older sound cards and slower computers, many of those did not use interrupts. So one result was when my computer was too slow, the output to the sound card was choppy. There were gaps in between because the CPU did not manage to look fast enough at the sound card and to see if it needed more data. But with interrupts, it gets notified just in time. OK, so I could now create a different instruction cycle diagram, which includes the interrupt as a special phase. But we'll see in more detail on the following slides what this actually means. This is the full diagram. And it has changed actually mostly in this part. So after executing a complete instruction, so the granularity of interrupt control or interrupt handling is really limited to the granularity of executing one single instruction, it checks for an interrupt. If there's no interrupt, that's OK. So I continue just as normal. But if there's an interrupt, I jump into a new microprogram and execute this. OK, so I'm somehow used to having the slides on my right side. So this is why I'm always looking on the blackboard, because I expect the slides to be there. The layout of the control unit memory is, I have, as I said before, always a sequence of micro instructions. And usually the last instruction here is jump to fetch or interrupt. So this simply means if the whole microprogram has been executed, I need to check for the interrupt or fetch the next macro instruction. What we can see also here is that certain microprograms are longer or shorter than others. It really depends on what they are doing. So for instance, I expect in the Xeon Phi, the microprogram for divisions, to be very long because it's A, very slow, so it's perhaps executing a lot of operations. And I'm pretty sure they try to add a lot of hacks to speed it up for certain values. So I think dividing by one is much faster than dividing by arbitrary values. And I even think that dividing by powers of two is faster, because you usually can speed this up by just shifting bits, or in the case of floating point numbers, just by moving the exponent. Okay, to sum this up, microprogramming gives us a lot of flexibility. It even allows us to provide some sort of compatibility, because I can suddenly teach my CPUs to accept different instruction sets. So they could, in theory, emulate other older CPUs. I'm a bit sad that no one's really leveraging this, because as you know, the PlayStation 3 is now phased out, but the PlayStation 4 cannot execute PlayStation 3 games. So now, slowly, the hardware which can run those games for the PlayStation 3 is dying out. Emulators for the PC are mostly not fast enough, or are still buggy. So this part of it's probably saying a bit too much to call this part of our culture, but it's still knowledge which is now being lost because we cannot reactivate old hardware. PlayStation 3 is known for dying early, just after a couple of years. So this will be lost, and if no one's investing into this, we will not be able to play those games any longer. But theoretically, via microprogramming, I could teach my Intel CPU to run a PlayStation 3 game, theoretically. Okay, I said all this before. Yeah, and as said, I can also sometimes fix bugs. Not all of them, but some. What we could also do is we could do this transformation between instruction sets in software. This is usually very slow, but if you look at software like QEMO, which is able to run, I think, ARM programs on a PC hardware, they can already do this translation. It costs a bit of performance, depending on how similar the CPU designs are. Okay, we still got 5 minutes, but I would like to end the lecture right now, because the next part would be RISC architectures, which is a very important design trait, because it was also a game changer for computer architectures. And if I started to explain those now, RISC architectures, we would not be able to finish them in time, and that would be confusing. So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you for being so many. And I look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. Next week, no lecture, no exercise this week. Next time we see each other in 2 weeks' time, and I will announce the room via mail. If I don't have any of your email addresses, please send me your email. But I'm rather confident that we'll be in the computer science tower in 2 weeks' time. Thank you very much.